Is it just me, or why are all these new saints Italian? What do you think, Stephanie? There's something in the water over there. Bartolo Longo, I think in one of the very first moments where I was considering religious life, I remember a podcast or something, hearing his name, that he was a tertiary with the Dominican Order and their commitment to preaching and the rosary and everything. And I think that was the very first time that kind of just in the back of my mind, that light bulb kind of went on and had said, maybe those people are also my people. So I have a certain affection for him. Thank you very much, Stefano, for those kind words. Thank you in a special way to David and Yana for their hospitality, taking me from the bus last night to Sister Henry Suso, and to all of the sisters for your incredible hospitality. It's a real pleasure to be here and an incredible honor to be preaching before such an esteemed chapter and in such a special place in the life of the Dominican Order in the United States and really around the world here in Nashville. As you heard, I'm not primarily an academic. My day job, I'm one of a handful of friars serving on a university campus with over 50,000 very bright students from all over the world, including the loved ones of multiple people in this room, which is very exciting. However, that also means that being, you know, on the front lines of a college campus is that my preaching at Mass, the beautiful thing is that every time that I preach at Mass, I'm preaching at somebody's first Mass, which is pretty incredible. I always, you know, as strange as this sounds, when somebody comes up to communion and doesn't know what's going on, and instead of getting flustered, I get excited, because that means that while we're doing what we're attracting people in a new way. But it also means that I don't necessarily get to preach with people with quite as much formation as you all have. And so that's also very exciting too. It's going to be a nice change of pace. The conferences you're hearing today are really the reflections of a spiritual father in response to what I see are some of the major spiritual issues of our day. You'll have to forgive me. I'm not going to cite every single source and every single book that I've read as inspiration for these. That would get somewhat tedious. If you're not, at the end of the day, you'll be getting some handouts that will have sort of a bibliography if you're wondering what Father's been reading this year, along with some questions for discussion. It's providential that we're having this day of reflection on the feast day of our Holy Father Francis. In those early days, you know, when I was sort of maybe hearing a little bit about Bartolo Longo, I immediately dismissed the notion of being a Franciscan. I knew immediately that I wasn't a Franciscan. They seemed like me to be a bunch of hippies. And maybe I was right to a certain degree. But in the end, God got the last laugh. Actually, this year I've mentored and shepherded both one young man and one young woman into Franciscan life, one to be a conventual Franciscan friar, and another to actually enter a Poor Clare cloister. And so I've gotten to know their charism and their history very well. And I think he does actually have something very profound to say to us today. In fact, this past August 8th, I got to preach on the Feast of St. Dominic to the Poor Clare nuns. And now I get to preach on the Feast of St. Francis to Dominicans. So it's a very ecumenical year for me. The title that I went with for today was Being a Liturgical People in the Age of AI, which I recognize as shamelessly topical. It seems like everybody these days has some thought or another on what does AI mean? Is it good? Is it bad for our society? I promise, I hope, this won't be yet another just kind of one-sided diatribe. I think God is actually inviting us into something much deeper in terms of reflecting on what does it mean for us to be Christians in the midst of such rapid change. In his bull announcing this year's Jubilee of Hope, Pope Francis said this. He said, "We need to recover the joy of living, since men and women created in the image and likeness of God cannot rest content with getting along one day at a time, settling for the here and now, and seeking fulfillment in material realities alone. This leads to a narrow individualism and the loss of hope. It gives rise to a sadness that lodges in the heart and brings forth fruits of discontent and intolerance." We all need hope because of the effects of sin in our lives that leave no aspect of our being untouched. We can look back to Genesis 3 and God's description of the punishment that Adam and Eve receive after their first sin. To Eve, God says, "I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." To Adam, God says, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. In other words, it's true what we say in this classic tradition that sin darkens our intellect and weakens our will, that it creates a debt to God. But what it actually does is perhaps even more profoundly distressing than that. Because what it does is it takes the spot in God's creation and the hierarchy of creation in which we were put as human beings, and it creates alienation among all those different parts. So, of course, what's the first thing that Adam and Eve do when their sin is discovered? They hide from God in shame. We notice that separation. What do Adam and Eve do to each other? Blame. And indeed, God says really specifically to Eve that now this relationship between husband and wife of mutual love, that disorder is going to enter into that as the result of sin in their hearts. And even as we look down the hierarchy of creation, that God turns to Adam and says that you will experience alienation, get this, even from the land will be cursed to you. That the effect of sin is that no longer will that which was made for us to have dominion over be instinctively serving us in that way, or will we have the ability to instinctively bring it into our place in the hierarchy? Our three conferences today will focus on each of those three dimensions of alienation, with our neighbor, with creation, and with God. And in each way, imagining how God is inviting us into a deeper mode of communion. And since I don't know any of you very well, I am interested in hearing your thoughts. So we've intentionally left time at the end of each conference for questions and answers. And we'll have more time for discussion as the day goes on. Last week, I was walking through the middle of Purdue's campus, and I was struck by an eerie feeling. On the one hand, as I'm walking down right next to Memorial Mall, just a few hundred yards from St. Thomas Aquinas, I was surrounded by over 100 people, right? So this is that 10-minute passing period when everybody gets out of class and everybody's going to class, and a lot of people are going from the same place, or coming from the same place, going to the same place. And I'm in the habit of, when I'm walking around campus, I don't have headphones in, maybe I'm praying a rosary or something like that, but I try to be present to the people around me. You know, you never know who's going to make eye contact with you or say hello to you. And the eerie feeling that I felt was because, despite the fact that I was surrounded by dozens and dozens and dozens of people, outdoors in the middle of a day on a college campus with a bunch of people who presumably have a lot in common with each other, it was utterly silent. Nobody was saying a word to each other. For most of them, it was because they had headphones in. They were presumably listening to music or a podcast or something like that. But in that moment, I just felt this weight of what sin has done to us and to our communities. That in many ways, we become individuals who have been closed in on ourselves and our own minds and our own thoughts and our own desires without attention to those around us. Of course, noticing loneliness and individualism is nothing new. It wasn't invented during the pandemic. Most of you are probably old enough to remember there was the book, I think it came out in 2000, Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, which looks at the decline of social institutions in American society in the 20th century. There's another narrative that points back to the Industrial Revolution as the great source of our isolation, and we'll get to that as the day goes on. Others point to the Enlightenment. There's a particularly Dominican narrative of history that says everything went wrong with that dastardly Franciscan, William of Ockham, who espoused the ideas of nominalism, for those who know what that is, departing from, good to mystic scholastic metaphysics. If only we were all good Thomists, the world would be a better place. And of course, there's truth in those narratives, but the reality is that this alienation goes back to the very beginning. Whether we look at what Adam and Eve did to each other, or what Cain did to Abel, alienation, blame, violence have been there from the beginning, in which we look out at our world and we focus on, what am I able to get out of this person or this circumstance? And I wish I could say that Christianity, that we Christians were immune to this, but the more time that I spend around contemporary Christianity, at least here in the United States, is that it can fall into the same traps of individualism. On our college campus, there are, a couple dozen different, student ministries, and it's not simply a matter of, the Lutherans go here, and the Baptists go here, the Presbyterians go here, the Catholics go here, that simply based on the personality of a particular Bible study leader or the type of music that's done in this place or that place, people hop around according to their preferences. Even in our own Catholic ministry, sometimes we fall into making our Christianity really more about emotional therapy, right? How does my relationship with Jesus make me feel good? Sometimes it's a purely intellectual exercise. How is it that the books that I can read and the knowledge that I can gain can make me superior to others? Sometimes it's aesthetic, right? That I'm the best because I know the most beautiful Gregorian chant, or that I know the most beautiful art. How does God actually save his people? We take for granted that after the fall, after the flood, that when God wanted to start this process of saving humanity, that he called one person, Abraham. And that out of his line would grow eventually the Israelites and everything that came from them. That we have there the beginnings of what we might call a people of God. But the reality is, as much as we take that for granted because of Sunday school, maybe we've been hearing that since we were small, God could have done it differently. He could have gone to every individual person around the world and simply zapped the truth of his existence and his love and his fidelity into each of them. But he didn't. Instead, he chose to mediate his covenant through a particular family, through a particular set of relationships, in which their relationships to each other were going to be distinct from their relationships with other people around the world or other people whom they were going to encounter. And by mediating his revelation through a particular people, it does this funny thing, where it establishes that those people who hear him are no longer simply another collection of individuals existing in the world, but that because the faith has been passed on from one person to another or from one generation to the next, that actually their existence, particularly their existence as members of God's family, are contingent upon the life and the actions of other human beings. If we were to go back to the time around Vatican II and the years thereafter, right, people of God was sort of the phrase of the day. You don't hear about that quite as much in church. It kind of got a bad rap a little bit. It got abused in a lot of senses of where you say, well, we're all the people of God, and so that means that we don't really need the hierarchy. In some cases, we don't really need priests all that much. Which is all sort of, we're in this together. And the church sort of became, in some people's minds, the kind of formless mass of individuals. But it doesn't need to be so. Now, it's tricky in English. We have this word people, which is, of course, mainly we use it as the plural of the word person. People is primarily a plural noun for us. But in theology, when the church uses this word people, it's primarily a singular noun. Latin populum, Italian popolo, right? Pueblo in Spanish, pueblo in French. What we're identifying is a group of persons who share some common life together. Now, sometimes that's sort of the unchosen people that we are born into, whether that's a family or a clan or a nation. Sometimes it's the peoples we choose. Like when we choose to marry somebody and start, as it were, a small refraction of peoplehood in the world. Or, for that matter, when we attach ourselves to a religious order. We choose to be part of people sometimes. And yet, as far as I can tell, a robust peoplehood is marked by three key concepts. And conveniently enough, I'm going to do this thing that religious often do, is when we have three concepts, we map them onto the evangelical virtues, the evangelical counsels. So we all take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, right? And all Christians are indeed called to live those virtues. And my argument is that a healthy people is going to exhibit those in a particular way among themselves. First, poverty. By existing in these interlocking or nested close-knit communities, human beings develop these relationships of what we might call mutual gratuity, relationships of gift. Well-functioning families don't obsess over whose turn it is to perform every little task. While some specialization and organization is necessary, we take care of each other. We take what we have and we put it at the disposal of the people, of the community. Second, what makes a people healthy is a kind of chastity. And by that, I mean that our love is distinct for this particular people. To be married to one person is to not be married to another. To be consecrated in a vow of chastity to God is to say I'm not going to be married to anybody else. To say that I'm going to belong to a people in a particular way is to say that I'm intentionally not belonging to other peoples in quite the same way. It's true that sometimes things can change, right? You can immigrate from one country to another. But that choice is a somewhat radical one. That if I were, let's say, bouncing from country to country, year to year, to say this year I want to be Spanish, this year I want to be French, this year I want to be American, this year I want to be Japanese, I would probably end up actually being none of those things at the end of the day. Is that fair? Yeah. This winds up in the theological concept we call the order of love, the order of mores, which is that idea that God has put particular people, particular relationships in my life that because I'm a finite being, I can focus on in a particular way. Right? If you are a parent, you should worry more about whether your own children are fed than whether the neighbor's kids are fed, right? Or whether there's somebody around the world is fed. We always take in mind that the preferential option for the poor, and we never want our communities, our peoples, to be closed off and to be indifferent to the needs of those on the outside. And yet we recognize that in those relationships is something special. The third mark of a healthy people is obedience. By that I mean a kind of givenness to the dynamics of a community. That the community is in some sense given to me. That we don't ultimately have total control over the persons who belong to our people or the aspects of those people that I choose to engage with. We certainly don't choose the families or to the nations that we're born into. And even when some choice is involved, true membership in a people means that to some extent we are throwing ourselves into an unknown future of that people. So for instance, those that are in the process of becoming Dominicans, you don't know exactly what this chapter of Dominican laity is going to look like 1, 5, 10, 20 years down the road. I didn't know what the Dominicans were going to look like when I chose to join. Right? When you marry somebody, you don't know what the future is going to have in store for your marriage. And you're committing to those people anyway. In some ways, that's the one way of thinking about a kind of contraceptive view of the world, is to say, instead of saying, I'm going to receive those who are given to me, instead I'm going to try to control and gatekeep who my love belongs to. The result is that a strong view of peoplehood rejects a purely transactional model of human nature, which is where we opt in and opt out of whatever aspects of relationships that we happen to deal with, right? So when I go to Walgreens, I'm not getting deeply invested in that relationship, right? I pick the thing off of the aisle, right? And I take it to the person, right? I give you the money, you give me the thing, right? That's a transactional way of experiencing reality. To truly belong to a people is to embrace discomfort and dependence. We Americans, we love independence. We see that as the great value of what does it mean to be a responsible citizen, is that I don't have to ask for help for anybody, right? I am productive, I am self-sufficient. But actually, to belong to a people is to say that I cannot truly be myself simply on my own. And that there are going to be people who belong to me in a certain sense, who have a claim on my love, right? Those of you who are parents of children will instinctively get this, or those who have cared for aging parents, hopefully, will instinctively get this. That there's room within a people for persons, individuals, of different gifts, different states in life, different personalities, different strengths and different weaknesses. I'm reminded of the Evelyn Waugh's novel *Brideshead Revisited*, where there's a character who, has had a religious conversion, but he's also an alcoholic, and his way of sort of fitting in for the church, at least for a little while, is to run off to a monastery in North Africa, Franciscans, I believe, and funny how they always come back. And he's basically going to work the door for a little bit. And he can't do very much. And they say, every couple of weeks, he disappears for a few days with his alcoholism, finds his way back. And that community was able to find a place for him because they were able to say that this man belongs to us, even if he's not always convenient. Hopefully, our experience as Catholics will resonate with these criteria. We're clearly a distinct people. We probably all had the experience of meeting some Catholic on the other side of the world or from the other side of the world, and we realize that we have more in common with that person than we do maybe with the person who lives next door to us. We all have, unique practices that set us apart and make us distinct. We certainly encounter kind of the givenness of being Catholic, the idea that certain relationships are given to us that we don't necessarily choose. We all watched the conclave earlier this year with, I suppose, varying degrees of bated breath, wondering who the new pope was going to be. I know I didn't get a vote, yeah? And he's my pope anyway, and I love him. Or even, on a more closer level, waiting for, say, a new bishop or a new pastor. What I love about being Catholic, we sometimes take for granted that we baptize infants. But the babies that we baptize, they don't choose their faith consciously. I have lots of conversations with Protestants about this sort of thing. In fact, one of the favorite conversations that I get to have, we're a university parish, so we have a full religious ed program. So I get to interview the confirmation candidates who are, 13, 14 years old. And my favorite question that I love asking them is in terms of what confirmation is about. And you would think because it's a confirmation interview, they would see the trick question coming, but they never do. I ask them, if we're in a tough situation where a baby's in the hospital and we don't know whether the baby is going to make it, what sacraments do we give the baby? And being bright 14-year-olds who have learned the seven sacraments from catechism class, they always say, what do you think? Baptism. That's good. Actually, they usually miss baptism because they assume, right, baptism, very good. And then what's the next one they say, do you think? I heard somebody say anointing of the sick. That's very good. David, you're a great, I think I planted you, right, to give the wrong answer. Is that fair? We confirm little babies in the Catholic Church. That's actually the norm in the Eastern churches. Because our faith, God's grace, is fundamentally not about something that I choose. Yeah, there can be rites of passage where we choose to become a Dominican, or we choose to maybe embrace the faith in a new way or for the first time after being away for a while. But fundamentally, being Catholic, being Christian, is about being chosen, not so much about choosing. By adopting this mentality, a robust understanding of what it means not just to be persons who have relationships with God, but to be a people with a relationship with God, I think this will actually go a long way in the direction of breaking out of, I think, some of the domestication that Christianity so often suffers from. There's something that's maybe happened in the church, I'm gonna say since the Protestant Reformation, where because of the polemics that are going on around us, where we have to intellectually justify why it's better to be Catholic than, you know, Lutheran or Calvinist or whatever the case is, that it's easy to define being Catholic in terms of what are the doctrines that we ascribe to. And that's good. We should ascribe to the teachings of the church. I'm a Dominican. I'm not denying that for one second. But that sometimes what we miss is that we stop at the level of intellectual assent. And maybe, sure, we recognize, you know, Jesus tells us to take care of the poor in Matthew 25, so we donate to the St. Vincent de Paul Society or whatever the case is. But that instead, what Jesus is calling us to is an identity as a church to be a people in an even more robust way. What a lot of young adults experience when they say come to a really good college campus ministry for the first time is where church is more than just a collection of families that happen to come to Mass in the same place. Maybe they go to youth group or something like that, and then they go home. That actually what it means for them to be church on their best days, they're not always at their best days, is that their faith in Christ is sort of the glue by which they develop these really, really deep relationships of mutual gift. Or even where they're not within those four walls of St. Thomas Aquinas, that they take care of each other. They help each other study for exams when they need to. They know who might be struggling with cash, and they make sure that, you know, they get their next meal or that they're included in whatever the thing is. They know who's been struggling, say, with mental health, and they give them a call and they look out for them, make sure they get to the next day. Unfortunately, oftentimes what happens is that people leave, say, a tight-knit university community, which admittedly has all kinds of advantages of college students, even though they'll tell you they're busy, they have way more free time than any other point that they'll ever have again in their lives. And there's a certain flexibility that comes with, you know, being able to stay up until 2 a.m. and talk about the deeper things of life. You know, praying Compline at midnight is not something that I intended to do when I joined the order. But when a 19-year-old asks you to sing the Psalter with them, you say yes. Unfortunately, what happens is people go from a really tight-knit community like that, and then they go out into, say, the parishes of the Catholic Church, and they experience a great poverty. That, in fact, the people around them at Mass, at least as far as they can tell, that it's a little bit like the spiritual version, the church version, of when I was walking down the mall in college, and there's a bunch of people who happen to be in the same place, but nobody's talking to each other. Nobody's in relationship with each other. Nobody knows who's struggling. Nobody knows who just lost their job. Our parishes wind up being more like voluntary associations rather than true peoples, or peoples within the broader people of the church. One of the themes is that at least for the morning, I'm not here to propose answers. In some ways, that's not my job as a priest. I spent a lot of years studying philosophy and theology. I learned a thing or two about how to give a talk. Nobody's nodding off yet. But actually, I believe that it's all of you, the laity, who can take in the tradition of the church, the radical challenge of the gospel, to love the people around us, and actually say, what does this look like in practice? I would hope that a true, authentic revival of Catholic life, of parish life in this country, would be so immediately obvious and visible to our broader society that not just the beautiful chanting, not just the beautiful churches, but that the relationships that we have among ourselves in light of God's incredible love for us, is what will be attracting droves and droves of converts. I'm gonna take a pause there. We can take a moment of quiet time to reflect, and then I'll call for questions, and if anybody wants to just raise your hand and offer a comment or a question or an objection, you can feel free to do so, okay? Would anybody like to offer a question or a response in the back? And if you could just say your name for me before your question.
Was the church always just a collection of families? Was there a turning point when, you know, were we what you, you know, the ideal at some point, the community experience, and then suddenly there's this, is that part of the Industrial Revolution? I mean,
yeah.
Well, was it
sure.
It's not an act.
Sure. Right.
It's not an act. You know, it didn't start that.
Mm-hmm. But even there, there was sin there, right? You can imagine the stories of those early believers who, right, held back from the community and met their untimely demise. I think a lot changed. If you think about the history of the Catholic Church in the United States in particular, for a long time, we were really a church of immigrants. You go back 100 years, right, to these kind of ethnic enclaves, especially in those kind of larger northern cities or maybe some of those small towns. And within that, your parish was the locus around which all of life revolved, from what I've been told. I mean, it was your school, it was your social hall, it was where you went for material assistance. A lot of that changed over the course of the 20th century. We are still very much a church of immigrants in a lot of places, but not necessarily the same way in others. One of the things that I'll talk about later this morning that we can't ignore is just the way that our metropolitan areas were sort of restructured. Not so much around, right, neighborhoods that we walk around, but now a lot of us, you know, live in suburbs or we drive from place to place. Just dramatically changes the way that we interact with people day to day. I think, and anybody feel free to correct me on this, I think the numerical decline of women's religious life in this country has been an ecclesial disaster. So I think we need to be praying for more vocations to women's religious life, because I think there always has been a particular, I'm going to say feminine sensitivity to the particular needs of particular families, that when every child was going, a Catholic child, was being taught by sisters in Catholic school, when you had sisters staffing, you know, so many healthcare facilities, facilities for the poor, right? That brought people in a different way, that people can look to a consecrated religious and say, oh, that person belongs to me and I belong to her or to him. That when we lose that, our churches, our parishes start to look a lot like any other nonprofit organization, which is by nature going to be a little bit more transactional. That's a good question. Excellent question. Anybody want to offer a response to that or ask something else? Up front.
Mm-hmm. Sisters who
issue of they, what the ethnic parishes had was a certain charism, mm-hmm. I would say,
yeah.
like coming from like the Italian parishes all saying Stabat Mater in Italian, mm-hmm. paraded through the streets. There was a way in which they made the faith, some of the abstract doctrines, kind of what you referred to, really come alive for the people.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if this idea sort of the charism,
mm-hmm.
if there is a way to revitalize the charisms through third orders and to help make concrete and real and to develop parish life, right? This kind of how do we help parishes? Obviously, the waves of immigrants, that sort of over in a sense. So how do we bring the sort of the faith alive again? Do you think charisms are the answer to that?
Yeah, that it, so the question was, as particularly, I mean, immigration from Spanish-speaking countries obviously is still going strong, and that's still a significant part of the life of the church. Different dioceses handle it different ways. You know, in my diocese, we don't do the national parish thing. We just say each parish kind of has a Spanish mass. I think we need some way to avoid the tendency of just saying, well, I'm a Catholic and that's it. There's something beautiful about that, right? I think of, you know, there can be a kind of unhealthy parochialism that says, I belong to Our Lady of Mount Carmel first, and I'm a Roman Catholic second. Okay, well, that's backwards. But how can we make particular groups of people love each other in particular ways and give them the opportunity to do that? I believe this is a true story. I was told this was a true story, where an American of some stripe asked Pope John Paul II, who spent much of his time promoting all kinds of different lay apostolates, right? Different kinds of lay fraternities in the church. You can sort of imagine, right, all those different ones where in Europe, that's really where the Catholic energy has been, even more strongly than in the United States. And they said, Holy Father, like, why aren't you paying any attention to the parishes or talking about the parishes as a place where people can encounter one another in a deep way? And allegedly what the Pope said was, like, you don't understand that the United States is the only place in the West that still has any concept of a parish as the center of Catholic life. When there's a block, you know, a parish that's a block from each other in all these different places and say in many European cities, what can easily wind up happening is that the people who are really fervent in the faith are maybe geographically diluted, and so they say, we're going to join the lay Dominicans, or we're going to join Communion and Liberation, or whatever the case is. Maybe it's not perfect. I think there is something to be said for why the church makes the territorial parish the norm. That there's something about being able to rub elbows, go to the same grocery store, go to the same schools as the people that you are worshiping with. I don't think being a lay Dominican is the answer to everything. It's not a substitute for belonging to your parish. But I think, and particularly in cases where the parishes themselves are not especially strong, that this can be a kind of leaven for the rest of the church. That the encounter that you have with one another here, with your particular gifts, your particular personalities, right? Dominicans, we tend to see the world in a particular way, different from those Franciscans. that there's going to be a bond that is just naturally going to develop. So I think, yeah, I think that's fair. Over here. And what's your name?
Silvana.
Silvana. Thank you, Silvana.
Yeah, I wanted to give share, like, something. You were talking about a topic that I talked about, and it's something that came into prayer. I've been praying for a long time to have something to revive all my church. For a long time, my age was kind of falling apart as a young adult. And not that's just prayers, because one of the first things that he put in my life was a quote from Swain Bonaventure, that he said something along the lines that if you put me in a monastery,
That's beautiful. Thank you. In the back? At our campus ministry, we do what's called a mission training every semester where we say, okay, so you're trying to follow Jesus, you love Jesus, and you're like, why doesn't anybody else that in my life, they don't seem to know God? And honestly, the first thing that we teach them to do is just paying attention to people. Be the kind of person that notices other people, that's curious, that sees their needs, their desires, their fears. Some people, they want to become Catholic because they watched enough Thomistic Institute videos or Bishop Barron videos and they were convinced. Those people exist. Most of the time, this process happens because they have a trusting relationship with somebody who is a strong believer. And the pretext of that relationship wasn't, we both love Jesus together. It was, we're neighbors, we're coworkers, something like that. I think we probably have time for one more, so I'll take this in the middle here.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Especially since you're a campus minister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, about Catholics, I believe, like the vibrant campus community, they go out into the diocese in Nashville, let's say, and I think they still think, like, you know, we're just one big Catholic community, so I'll go, like, all the family on Monday.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you're describing, which is very real, and even probably before I joined the order, I was probably guilty of that for a time. I call it liturgical tourism or liturgical kind of consumerism, right? Where sort of look at the menu of all the Catholic stuff that's available in my area, and I pick which ones do I like the most, and I kind of participate in those. I think we have to rub against the mentality where everything that I'm going to do at church has to be catered to me and to my demographic. So what happens is people growing up, right, they go to a Catholic school or they go to religious education, whatever the case is, and then they have youth group while they're in high school, they have their campus ministry while they're in college, and then they go to grad school and now there's a grad student group, and they get out and okay, now I have to belong to a young adult group of other people that are like me, because only we are really gonna understand each other. Intergenerational living is hard. It's hard enough when everybody's a Dominican and everybody's made vows and like we all love you. Like it's even harder when like it's just true that a 75-year-old in 2025 and a 25-year-old in 2025 have largely had radically different experiences of the church and oftentimes have different expectations of what the church can and should be based on that. I think whatever opportunities we can take to have people of different generations coming together, to have the young couple who's engaged talking to the family who's been married for 50 years, or the couple that has two little kids talking to, you know, the couple with teenagers or the empty nesters who have been there before. I think we will be much better off as a church. And it could be that the more people get a taste of that way of being Catholic, these are my people, and you know what? People who are older or people who are little, I mean kids, it's true. They demand our time and attention in a different way than somebody else who is 28 years old and able-bodied. Fine. But there's something infantilizing about that if we never break outside of that. So,